You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
At the very least, you can say that a devastating midterm loss doesn't portend anything negative for the president.
Pretty exciting episode today. We're going to have Matt Lewis on, and you may know Matt Lewis, senior columnist at The Daily Beast. You may have seen him on CNN as a political commentator. He's also the host of Matt Lewis and the News podcast. So go ahead and sign up for that. We're going to talk midterms. I told this story back in 2007, so I think one of the good things about having a podcast for what is now 12 years, 2006 when it started, is that, hey, I can repeat a few stories, right? We have a lot of new listeners now, I would hope. You may know your history, but you may not know that in the middle of the Civil War, 5 months after Union troops had repelled the Confederate Army, advancing on Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, Abraham Lincoln found that his own Congress was under attack. But it wasn't the great Confederate Army commanded by Robert E. Lee threatening to grasp the Capitol Dome, then under construction, from Lincoln's control. It was a short, bearded man, a clerk named Emerson Etheridge. Lincoln's Republicans had been hurt by the midterms of 1862, and now they actually represented a tactical minority of Congress, the Republicans did. It was only with the newly elected Republicans from the new state of West Virginia and also from Oregon and also from Kansas that Lincoln held any power. Now, fearing funny business might go on when the old Congress ended in March of 1863. This is the before the days when Congress always started in January. They passed a law, which formally provided the clerk with the ability to certify the credentials of members-elect, new members coming in. It allowed the clerk to count loyalists from the portion of the South under Union military control if it was needed. So if the Republicans needed three extra votes, say, on a House measure, they could go to the Louisiana Territory, an area of Louisiana right around New Orleans that was now under Union control, and maybe get three representatives from that area. But the statute didn't say it was limited to those southern states where the clerk could make a decision about credentials. And a problem with the whole theory of doing that is that Emerson Etheridge was from Tennessee. He had been a loyal administration supporter for the first year and a half of the war, but when the scene changed and the Emancipation Proclamation was passed, Etheridge, like some other Tennessee loyalist, opposed freedom and social equality for former slaves, and he felt betrayed by the Republican Party and betrayed by Lincoln. He's sitting there as clerk. Etheridge conspires in the city of Washington with Democrats and conservative unionists to, in effect, take over the House from the Republican Party. He decided that he would accept the credentials of Democratic and conservative unionist congressmen, but not the credentials of the new pro-Lincoln Republicans who had just been elected from those states. And the reason that he had this power is because of the statute and because of the fact that the speaker would not be sitting in the chair yet. Congress had just started, and there would only be one man, Etheridge, presiding, and no one to challenge his decision. So Why is this dangerous? Well, Lincoln faced the situation of many presidents after a midterm. And if he was to lose control of the House through such a procedure, there are a lot of war Democrats who are going to say, you know, we support the prosecution of the war. We support fighting the South. We support the Union being held together. But in practice, you're going to see a lot more investigation. You're going to see a lot more withholding of funds, a lot more questioning about the war, and much more attempts at peace and demands that the executive make attempts at peace with the South that are going to frustrate the war efforts. I mean, I think a good way to think about war Democrats sometimes, and there's variations between them. Some are just outright copperhead, basically supporting the South. And then you have some like Andrew Johnson, who really wanted to take it to the South, but just happened to be a Democrat by party. And you have somewhere in the middle, I think like Joel Parker of New Jersey is a good example. Bellyaching about Lincoln, about the prosecution of the war, about having to raise troops, but certainly once troops came near Gettysburg, raising a regiment of New Jersey volunteers and supporting and funding the Union effort. So you have a lot of variances, but you don't want people like Parker and his crowd, if you're Lincoln, in charge of the and his party in charge of the Congress. Well, in this, they had an ally, and that was Etheridge himself, because like many Washingtonians then and now, he talked a little bit too much about his great scheme. The word got out to the Republicans, and a very concerned President Lincoln. He summoned the Speaker-to-be, Colfax of Indiana, to the White House, and asked him to organize Republicans to be sure that they, he said, be sure our men get in there. In December of 1863, when the new Congress finally convened, it took a while back then between the midterm elections and when the new Congress would sit. Emerson Etheridge excluded 16 Republicans from the roll call vote. This would have been a loss of control. But Etheridge got a little ahead of himself in committing a parliamentary mistake that allowed Republicans to vote on a motion to table. The Republicans would do an excellent job of persuading members to vote no on the motion to table, which, once defeated, meant that the 16 members then had to be seated. But the close call was not a vote of confidence for the nation and a president at war. A Republican congressman from Massachusetts, Henry Dawes, compared the event to Bull Run, which had been a military disaster for the Union, and said he could think of nothing so disastrous. And so there's always this kind of speculation period when the House changes hands. The president is of an opposite party from the new House. In 1874, Democrats captured the House while Grant was president. You had this. And you saw a slew of investigations ensue. In 1890, when Democrats wrested control from Benjamin Harrison, Democrats initiated a series of bills contesting an unpopular McKinley tariff that had been passed. In 1894, when Republicans took it back under Democrat Grover Cleveland. In 1910, when the House was taken by Democrats from William Howard Taft. In 1919, when Republicans faced hostile Congress. When Woodrow Wilson faced a hostile new Republican Congress that was going to disrupt his plans for the Treaty of Versailles and disrupt his plans for a League of Nations. In 1930, when during the Great Depression, Democrats, and this is after a series of by-elections that occurred because the margin was so thin, took the House from Herbert Hoover. He still had the Senate. And interestingly enough, Herbert Hoover is probably the one president who didn't want the Senate. He actually asked the Senate to let the Democrats run the chamber so that they could share equal responsibility with the Great Depression. Senate Republicans then and now don't always listen to the president. They did not like that idea very much. Now, by 1933, they would be out anyway. With all the speculation about, you know, what happens, this is why I wanted to talk to Matt Lewis, We're going to talk a bit about presidents after midterms. And he has a kind of a controversial, but yet not entirely implausible theory about what happens next. Matt K. Lewis is a senior columnist at The Daily Beast, CNN political commentator, and author of Too Dumb to Fail. He's also the host of Matt Lewis and the News podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
So I guess we'll just go right into it. I mean, what did you think about the midterm result?
Well, it was interesting because when the polls first closed around like 7 o'clock Eastern time, we started to see things, results coming in and trickling in. I think my first instinct was pretty good night for Republicans. You know, Democrats were going to take the House. That was kind of baked into the cake. Mm-hmm. But it felt like Republicans were exceeding expectations, probably going to end up with like 53 or 54 Senate seats. And I think as the night wore on and as the days have gone on, it has started to look a little less positive for Republicans and more like, you know, what we would fairly call a blue wave.
Yeah, I was going to say that night that it was more of a wah than a wave. And it just had the beginning part of it. But I think as things went on, you could at least in the House races say the word wave and not look silly. It's nowhere near 2010, not as close to, say, 1994. I think that the expectations game and the baking things into the cake means so much now. And so everyone just simply expected the House. Well, meanwhile, it's a pretty big achievement to take a branch of Congress, right?
Definitely. But, you know, it wasn't a surprise. We had 9 months probably of this, you know, conventional wisdom saying Republicans are going to lose the House. So when it does happen, and at first it looked like it wasn't going to be that by that many seats, I think it's kind of greeted with a yawn. I think my headline that night was something to do with a trickle, not a wave.
Yep.
But again, if you look at it just in terms of the House, the magnitude and the accomplishment, it's a big deal what happened. And, you know, and I think also some of these other races, you know, like election night, we thought Martha McSally would be the new senator from Arizona. And of course, Kristen Sinema is. And so like a lot of things like that ended up kind of changing, some surprises that happened over the next couple of days. And we still don't know what's going to happen exactly down in Florida.
Yeah, true. True. As we're talking, the Scott's ahead, and it seems like a significant amount, but that's still under some contest. We'll see what happens with that Senate race. The talk was definitely more towards Republicans in the Senate races, more towards Democrats in the House races in terms of the expectations game. And, you know, you thought, for instance, like Heller was looking a little stronger running up to that election, and then that was just in – boom, Nevada ticked off.
And by the way, I've heard from sources that everybody, I want to say everybody, so all the experts, the commentators, they said that Heller was in trouble. But Heller's people, I'm told, believed that they were going to win and that their modeling of the polling was actually wrong. And interestingly, apparently it's with seniors. I'm looking into this right now, but it appears that one of the kind of underrated stories of the night was how senior citizens broke against Trump in a way that they normally don't break against Republicans in midterms.
That would be an interesting story if you see. I mean, that was Obama's worst performing group, I would say, throughout his entire presidency, through both races, that, you know, 60 or above. And to it's interesting. It might be like a who showed up type thing. Those who showed up in the midterm who were of that age, you know, were tending to cast a vote against Trump versus the entire voting base being suddenly against Trump. It would be interesting.
Yeah. It's so hard to tell. And also, I mean, you're going off of things like, exit polling. We don't really know how seniors voted, but
that's true.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more, we answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerd will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the Nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Anyway, that's something to look out for. Everybody's talking about the suburban moms and the college-educated white women. Not a lot of talk about seniors.
One of the reasons I wanted to touch base with you is you had a very interesting article that was about, and this was prior to the midterm, but with indications that Democrats would take the House, that you actually felt this would be a positive for President Trump.
Well, look, I think you could definitely make the argument that at the very least, you can say that a devastating midterm loss doesn't portend anything negative for the president. There's just not a harbinger of things to come. You could maybe even argue it's helpful. But in modern history, two things, there are basically, you know, two trends that seem pretty steady. Trend number one is that presidents tend to have horrible midterms, their first midterm election, and presidents tend to get reelected. And I don't know if it's, you know, causation or just correlation, but that those two things tend to go hand in hand. And so at the very least, I don't think you could look at what happened, last Tuesday night and then say, well, this shows that Donald Trump can't get elected. This shows that that it's insurmountable. I just don't think you can do that. I some of it may be warning. You know, maybe Trump should take heed. I'm not saying he should ignore it, but I also don't think it's predictive.
Yeah, I mean, my own opinion of it, I think that in terms of taking heed, far be it for me to suggest anything to the president. I'm sure his advisors only go in there with the most trepidation, but he's going to do what he's going to do. That's fairly obvious. That's his style. And, but I do think that my quick lesson on it is just that there's a lot of talk about the left or, you know, like it's a small group. It's a private club that's hanging out near Berkeley or something. And I think enlarging one's view of what the left electorate might be would be helpful and might be at least, very least, trying to find the factions which you can peel off if you're to be a successful president. Just because you noted history, and, you know, I talk a lot about history, the examples, Obama, Clinton, Eisenhower, Truman, these are all good examples of where, you know, you lose the House and win your reelection. There are some interesting things with all of those. The Truman, Truman's an interesting case. You know, there was definitely talk that he wouldn't be reelected in 48 after losing the House in 46. He obviously did the famous, you know, kind of do nothing Congress.
Yeah. You know, what's funny? Sometimes you come across cool stuff that just doesn't fit into a 700 word column. But I went in, I looked up Harry Truman's speech at the Democratic Convention when he won the nomination in he was the incumbent president, but the speech he gave at the Democratic National Convention in the summer of 1948, about 75% of the speech is him bashing the Congress, the Republican Congress. I mean, it's amazing. This wasn't like a side issue for him. This wasn't like he's going to run on a lot of things, and one of the things he does is attack the do-nothing Congress. Like, this was, you know, based on that speech, I mean, this was the bread and butter of his campaign, was attacking the Republican Congress.
Oh, absolutely. And he was primed for it. I think it was like late at night when he had to make the speech, and there was this moment where they were to release these birds, I guess, you know, without like advanced video graphics at the time in 48, you know, you did things like releasing doves, you know, as a speech was to begin. One of them drops right to the floor. You know, so he comes out, but he gives this speech, and the DNC is tired. And I mean, they don't think they're going to win this. And yeah, he really electrified people. There's a slight thing that I always want to point out with the do nothing Congress thing that might be different from the Trump situation, is that the Republicans had had their convention. And if you go back and look at that 48 platform, I had an old podcast where I did. I don't remember all of the points, but things like slum clearance, aid to education. There were all these very liberal, healthcare, all these very liberal type platforms. Some of them might have been expressed in a little bit more like, free market way. But the goals of all the programs are very similar to what the Truman wanted to do. So it put him in a very good position to be able to have that speech and then call the Congress together and say, hey, I agree with you. Let's, you know, get this done. I'm calling you into session. So you have a little bit difference here where there's definitely a difference of philosophy. And it's not going to be as simple as, hey, you and I agree, Pelosi. But I also, having said all that, I wonder if it even matters. I mean, Trump could still use that argument. It's a very powerful argument for a president to use. Like, I'm trying to get things done in Congress. They're not letting
me. Yeah, I mean, that's part of my argument that of why a bad midterm, losing the House at least, might help Trump is it helps him spread the blame.
Now,
look, he's going to blame people whether there's a plausible – you know, whether there's a plausible motive or not, but this makes it plausible. He can plausibly spread the blame, and I think he will definitely do that.
And he gets the Senate. And my feeling is, I had a cast on this in the past called King's Rook, just the idea that when a president loses the House but they keep the Senate, they have that defensive mechanism like you would in a chess game where you can cover your king with the rook. And Reagan had it, Taft, Wilson, there's a couple presidents. Oh, Obama obviously had it for 6 years where you have the Senate, but not the House. I guess, you know, I don't know how you feel about it. I thought about it this morning. I said, if I was a president and had a choice, just you could only pick one, I would pick the Senate.
Yeah. If you could only keep one. And, you know, I think that's true for a couple reasons, especially true for Trump, right? On one hand, you need the Senate to remove a president, 2/3 vote in the Senate to remove a president. Mm-hmm. So that's something Trump, more than other presidents, might have to worry about. And the other thing is, I think Trump's big legacy is probably judges. And it's the Senate right that confirms judges. So, yeah, I think definitely in the case of Donald Trump, if you had to lose one chamber, it would be the House. You would definitely want to keep the Senate.
You are a conservative, but you haven't always been seen eye to eye with Trump. And how do you feel now? As you know, it's been a couple of years, and then have you gotten the aforementioned judges? There's been some conservative appointments. Do you feel good about it? The fact that you got the judges, or is it a fair trade to say? Or
no, I don't think it's a fair trade. Mm. But I also say if you have to take the bad, you should take the good too. I mean. I just think Trump has done a lot of damage to the sort of the fabric, the social fabric of America. He's done a lot of damage to the Republican brand. I'm not over that. I'm not going to say, like, well, it all worked out. But I think if you have to have that damage anyway, and that probably was kind of, you know, a fait accompli, baked into the cake the moment Trump won the presidency, then you might as well get something good out of it, right? And so I think the judges, as a conservative, by and large, the judges are very positive. So I'm one of these people in the weird position of kind of taking things day by day and criticizing him a lot, you know, based on what he's doing to the culture and, you know, the polarization and attacking the media as enemies of the people, but also, you know, applauding him when he does something good, like, for example, pick a conservative judge.
Yeah, one of the things that the Senate candidate, now I forget her name, but the new senator in Arizona, it's a shame at a point of running, kind of in that fashion. In other words, he ran as a Democrat, but she wasn't one of the people that you might, if it was a New Jersey suburb or a California suburb where the whole thing's Trump. She's like, Trump's not a thing in my election. First of all, Trump's not a thing. I think that's one lesson for liberals. If they didn't achieve as much as they wanted in this midterm, that it might be time to start realizing that the person is a person, whatever you think. He's a president. He has the full powers of the office, and he's going to be there. I don't see any realistic impeachment prospects or anything like that. So it's time to start. There just seems to be a little bit of this. It's like something has happened to the country. Instead of thinking about a person being elected, even if it was the Electoral College, that's the system that we have. One thing that struck me in the midterm, I was curious if you felt the same way, is Ohio and Florida. So the positive news for me, even though I know Florida is still being counted as we speak, if you're on the GOP side, that Florida looks real good, and particularly for the Trump idea, the way that he...
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. To follow trends, track financial situations, follow gains and losses, check out the Yahoo Finance podcast. Every day, we'll give you a quick overview of the latest market and financial news that you need to know. You'll be able to hear about the biggest headlines in the business world in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. It's perfect to listen to while you make another cup of coffee or work out a new budget. Check it out now. Listen to Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
Talks and the style and the, to me, that just seemed to work very well in Florida. He has a home there. A lot of people from New York move there. And being a New Jerseyan and somewhat familiar with the New York type person, you know, I've seen examples that those who have moved there sometimes are moving away from cities, and now they're in Florida. And their kind of attitude can be a kind of Trump style. I'm going to say what I say. I'm going to do what I do. They might not agree with everything, but you saw that there was some strength there, and the Democrats had a lot of trouble in Florida. And then in Ohio, other than Sherrod Brown, and even he was somewhat close at 53%, it wasn't that positive for them. They're pretty important states.
Yeah, no, I think Florida's really interesting. Mm. And I'm sure if you had a liberal on, they would say, well, they were disenfranchising voters or something, and that's the reason Republicans did well in Florida. But
I mean, that could be looked at.
Let's just assume that everything's on the up and up, and the numbers are the numbers, and Republicans won the Senate and the governor, and retained the governorship and won the Senate seat in Florida. I find that the really fascinating one. Like, I understand why Trump has appeal in the Rust Belt. I understand why Trump has appeal in the Deep South. I understand why Trump has problems in the Southwest and in the suburbs. But Florida is the one that really is curious, why he does so well. And I think you make a really good point about all of the New Yorkers who moved to Florida. You know, something's up down there, and it could be – some of it could be Cuban Americans who are probably more pro-Trump than other Hispanics. Some of it could be just, Mar-a-Lago being having a place down there. But whatever the case, I think the assumption is for all the people who worry – about demographic trends, the assumption is that as Trump does better in the Deep South and in the Rust Belt, that Republicans and Trump specifically could start having problems in places like Nevada and Arizona and maybe even Texas and maybe even Florida. And what happened in Florida this time around at least kind of, dispels that concern.
Yeah, it's at least its usual purple, if not a reddish purple. Texas was interesting.
Yeah, I still think Beto O'Rourke would not be a bad presidential candidate, despite losing down there. That's kind of a controversial opinion, I think, these days. But I don't think Democrats look to me for advice, but I think they could do worse than nominating him.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of arguments. One, he is a House member, so it's not like he's totally just some person with no office, right? So you could say, okay, that you got to go back to James Garfield for that one. But, you know, I also do believe that presidential campaigns have to have a little poetry in them. They can't be boring. They can be, of course, if there's no other candidate nominated. That mm-hmm. wouldn't be boring. I mean, Trump certainly wasn't boring. And so you can make a case where a president has to kind of inspire and do things. I guess I see a dearth of candidates right now. So I certainly think that's valid.
Well, a dearth of good candidates. There's probably going to be 20
people. Yeah, 20 there's going to be a lot running. Of people running in Iowa, running for, I think almost running for VP. But right, candidates, to say good or bad, but candidates that you think you think about them up against Trump. And, you know, I always tell people in Ohio, if you have an idea, try it in Ohio. Well, how would your idea work in Ohio? So if you think about presidential candidates, you think they're going to win in Ohio. Maybe you don't need Ohio anymore, but it's been pretty useful, you know, up until recent times. So I wouldn't want to run a campaign without having a realistic chance of it. You know, you look at someone like Beto, maybe he can inspire enough, maybe a Biden, maybe Sherrod Brown. But yeah, everybody seems to be a little, unappetizing there. Another article that I saw or a tweet that you had is you had suggested that Trump perhaps swap VPs for the next election.
Right. So this is based on the premise that, you know, whether like say Bill Clinton and after the Republican Revolution in 1994, Bill Clinton comes back and wins re-election handily over Bob Dole. But part of the reason is he took it seriously. You know, he triangulated, he co-opted a lot of the Republicans' message. It doesn't seem likely that Donald Trump will be able to do that kind of thing. Like, Trump can't change who he is. He can't change his character. I think it's very doubtful that he would even try to pivot.
Right.
And do infrastructure and cut a deal with Chuck and Nancy. Like, even if even if they would go along with it, I don't know that Trump could stick to a deal longer than a half hour.
That's seems to be the problem, the sticking to it.
So the only, like, you know, tool left in his toolbox is to change the people around him. And we see him doing that, you know, right now, different positions. And, you know, I don't think it's crazy to think that Trump might decide, hey, how do I've got this problem. Everybody says – this is how Trump thinks. Everybody says I've got this problem with, you know, suburban women. And if you're Donald Trump, how do you fix that? Well, you can't fix yourself. You don't even think you need to fix yourself. Mm-hmm. So the way you fix things is to hire people to fix them. That's the premise. And I think that I don't know if it's going to happen. But, you know, Nikki Haley – she needs to do – if she wants to run in 2024, she needs to do something. She is a hot commodity right now.
That would be a great choice.
Incredibly appealing. Mm-hmm. But you can't sit around for 6 years and be the nominee. You just can't. You got to do something. Now, maybe that's, you know, Lindsey Graham becomes, you know, I don't know, head of the Justice Department, and she takes the Senate seat in South Carolina. I mean, but she's got to do something. So I think there's an argument for her to do this. There's an argument for Trump to do this. I do not know why Mike Pence would go along with this.
Well, it's interesting. History-wise, quickly, there a lot of people will look at it and say, well, this isn't something that people do. But actually, there's a lot of close calls. George W. Bush revealed in his memoir that he actually, Cheney offered, you know, without being prodded by him, if you want to drop me, drop me. You know, I was there for the first term. He also noted in his memoir that he wanted his father, he was a very strong advocate of having his father drop Quayle. Nixon wanted to drop Agnew. Eisenhower wanted to drop Nixon. There's a lot of presidential wanting to do this, but it seems like the vice presidents get institutionally stuck in there, and then they have a little bit of their own fan base, and also the president. This is what George H.W. Bush said, that the press would ruin him because you know, it would look disjointed, it would look confused.
It looks like you made a mistake or something. But FDR did it, I think, twice. Mm-hmm. And look, these are so what you're describing are norms, like post-World War II norms. Well, guess who likes to break post-World War II norms?
You're right there, yeah. I mean, I think it's an underused play myself, because incumbent presidents going to an election have very little to do to create some pizzazz. But, again, things are very different. Well, hey, it's been great talking to you, Matt. We definitely would love to have you on again sometime. Matt Lewis and the News podcast, go and sign up for that. Anything else that you you have a website or people should go to find out more about you?
Oh, just read my stuff at the Daily Beast, watch me on CNN, and please do go to iTunes and download Matt Lewis and the News.
Great. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for listening, and I want to thank Matt Lewis for coming on the show. Remember to catch him at the Daily Beast, on CNN, and on the Matt Lewis and the News podcast, his book, Too Dumb to Fail. Check it out. And our website is www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. If you're not subscribed to the show, please subscribe. Want to let you know, you should be downloading the Pandora Podcast Genome app, because we're on there. And that's a select group of shows that get to be on there. Not everybody does. So please think about that. Thanks for listening.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.